The rapid rise of Ebola in West Africa quickly created a health crisis in the countries of Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and raised concerns in neighboring countries and around the world, with media attention picking up here in the United States last fall.
And the story isn't over yet, but the spread of the disease appears to have been contained. Last week, a Liberian clinic released the last known patient with the disease in that nation, and the numbers are way down in other West African countries.
While the disease spread has slowed, two questions remain. What are the long-term consequences of the illness, and what did we learn that could help us in future outbreaks? Tony Goldberg joins us in the studio. He's a professor of epidemiology at the UW-Madison Veterinary School and associate director for research at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. Tony, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Well, before we get to lessons learned, I don't want to talk like, you know, in the past tense here with Ebola. Where is the disease still lingering?
So the outbreak is definitely slowing, but there are micro-scale outbreaks still occurring. So isolated cases and local spread, typically in areas that don't have good access to public health infrastructure.
And so is there still ongoing international outreach to those areas and from the countries involved?
There is. There's a sense that we're scaling down a bit and the outbreak has been contained, but we still have international presence and we're still trying to build local capacity.
So for people who had the disease and survived, what are the long-term impacts?
Well, there are physical and psychological impacts. So people are starting to talk about post-Ebola syndrome, which is an interesting constellation of symptoms. About half the people who survive Ebola suffer long-term vision loss, in some case leading even to blindness. So that's a major concern. And for those who survive the disease, they might have persistent headaches, body pain, fatigue, sort of long-term consequences that we don't really understand yet, and also psychological trauma. You know, Ebola, the narrative on Ebola before this outbreak and in the early years or in the early months was that it's a universally fatal, horrible disease. So if you went away from your village diagnosed with Ebola, you were not expected to come back. So for people who did come back, they often found themselves ostracized. Their houses and belongings may have been burned. They may have been accused of being witches for having come back from the dead, things like that. So it's not been an easy homecoming for those lucky enough to survive.
And there were stories even earlier in the outbreak of the stigma you're talking about being associated, even when people had survived and were past the point of contagion. So you're saying that stigma hasn't necessarily gone away.
That's right. It hasn't. It's a scary disease, and Ebola survivors are clearly their families and friends are very happy to see them back, but there's persisting fear. And for those people who don't understand that Ebola is a survivable disease, they're very fearful.
Well, I'm going to get to some of the lessons learned, and I'll start by listening to Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Last month, the BBC asked her about regrets about the way her country dealt with Ebola.
I would have engaged the participation and ownership of the communities at a much earlier stage. We tried containment through a little bit of force and a little bit of changing people's habits by demand and by fiat. We did not do enough with communicating with them on the severity of the disease, our own fears, our own lack of capacity. And so that created a certain amount of distrust as to what we were doing, as to whether we knew what we were doing.
Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf there. Tony, to the first point we heard there, how important is it to engage local people, local communities, and bring them on board as active participants in fighting a disease like Ebola?
It's critical. I don't think anybody at this point would disagree with the president of Liberia. One lesson we learned that I think we're going to have to take to heart is just how wrong we were about the projected number of Ebola cases we thought we'd see. Early in the epidemic, there were really horrible projections of between 1 and 2 million cases we could expect. But the actual number of cases as of today is only about 25,000. A lot still, but not to detract from the seriousness of those cases, but nothing like the 1 to 2 million. And one has to ask, why were we so wrong? What did we not take into account? And I think the president's statement speaks to that. We did not take into account the capacity of people to change their behavior and respond to the outbreak. So the initial projections were based on sort of an extension of transmission rates estimated from early in the epidemic, whereas in fact those transmission rates turned out to be much lower because people were changing their behavior.
I think when we hear about a disease like Ebola, there's a certain amount of fatalism. Like, this is going to spread. There's nothing we can do about it. Is this a common thing, though, that people can change behaviors in a fairly short order and nip diseases like this in the bud, no matter how bad they look up front?
That is not an established paradigm. Before this outbreak, I don't think most epidemiologists would have guessed that we would see such dramatic effects of people adapting to this crisis. I think we're going to have to change the way that we project outbreaks into the future. I think we're going to have to put greater attention on the capacity of people at a very local level to take care of themselves and to help in the process. And I think that's the message that the Liberian president got across so well.
And she also said there a thing that she thinks they got wrong. They didn't communicate enough up front. So is she right that transparency and honesty about what the government can do and what it knows and what it can't do and doesn't know, does that really help?
That really does help. If the key to stopping an outbreak is changing the behavior of people at the local level, they need to feel empowered to change their own behavior. If they're receiving mandates from above without clear explanations from people who claim to know what to do when in fact they might not know so well, then there's going to be distrust and sometimes unforeseen consequences.
Well, I think there's sometimes a fear like, well, we don't want to create a panic by saying we don't know these points or we're not in control. Are we overrating the fear of panic as a result of not enough information?
I think we are overrating the fear of panic. I think when people confront crises, they often rise to the occasion. And rather than panic, maybe we should have engaged people more as partners and worked with them rather than trying to tell them what to do.
And we've been talking, I think, mostly about what local governments or the national governments in these cases can do. Looking at the international community's response, are there things that could have been done better, that we could do better next time around?
Well, I think speaking to some of the same points, when the initial teams from international organizations came on the ground, there was the emphasis was on constructing these very elaborate Ebola treatment centers and creating centralized hospitals and public health and treatment infrastructures. And that was all necessary, but that may have happened a little bit too much in comparison to some of the local outreach and education efforts. And the other thing, getting back to what we originally talked about that was not anticipated and we're playing catch up with now, is what to do with the survivors. So not only are the people who survived Ebola suffering medical and psychological consequences, but there has been talk that those same people might actually have played a greater role in the treatment of Ebola patients after they recovered. If they're immune, for example, and not able to get the disease, maybe they could be useful in treating patients who are sick. In fact, there's local organizations like the Ebola Survivor Corps that are trying to work on that model of engaging survivors.
Do outside aid providers do enough to bridge cultural gaps? I mean, you think about a part of the way this was transmitted was based on local funeral customs of how the deceased are treated and what a crucial part of a culture that was. Do we pay enough attention to how we communicate sensitively that this cherished tradition may be part of the spread of the disease?
That particular practice you mentioned, funeral practices and preparing bodies for burial, was made a big deal of early on. And I think that was only one of many ways that the disease could be transmitted. So if anything, I think a sort of a more holistic view of the way that culture and disease transmission interact would have helped. So the short answer is yes, but it's a nuanced yes, because I think it really encompasses a deeper understanding of a suite of cultural practices.
Mm-hmm. And is this a case where, again, that community involvement, bring them, consulting with them as part of an international effort, could help with those nuances?
Absolutely. I think that's the only way. You know, really empowering local community leaders and just local people to take charge and provide suggestions that are culturally acceptable and implementable is the best way to tackle these outbreaks.
And I want to bring things home here to the United States. Dr. Craig Spencer, he was one of these international medical workers we've been talking about. He caught Ebola while volunteering there. He became the center of media attention when he came down. He showed symptoms of the disease back home in the U.S. He wrote a recent piece in a medical journal, very critical of the U.S. media, of U.S. politicians for creating a sense of irrational panic over the potential for Ebola here. Do you think our reaction here in the United States could have been done better?
Absolutely. I think one of the most disappointing aspects of Dr. Spencer's experience and the experience of those like him was the ostracization and vilification that he met when he came back. It reminds me a little bit of Vietnam soldiers returning from the war, you know, having done the best in difficult situations, only to find themselves sort of in the middle of a political fight and ostracized by certain segments of our society. So I think that Dr. Spencer and people like him should be commended for what they did and should be embraced as heroes. And yet he very poignantly describes how he found himself being taken advantage of by multiple sides.
Are there things we could do better in future outbreaks around the world to provide information, say, from the CDC, from politicians, from the media, to provide the kind of information we're talking about providing the people in West Africa?
I think so. I think dispelling misconceptions about Ebola and infectious diseases in general is very important. We know now that Ebola is not this universally fatal, horrible, zombie-like disease. It's pretty awful, but it's possible to recover. And if someone has recovered from Ebola, then they're not infectious anymore. And if someone has happened to catch the disease, their transmitting that disease can be prevented with appropriate care.
Briefly, Tony, as we wrap up, are we learning the right lessons, or are we kind of forgetting about them and we're going to be caught by surprise on the next outbreak?
I think it remains to be seen. I think we have learned some lessons, but time will tell whether we've internalized them. We still don't know the natural reservoir for Ebola. We don't know how the first case was transmitted to the first person. So we can expect that Ebola or diseases like it will emerge again. And I think the answer to your question will have to, unfortunately, await the next epidemic.
We'll leave it there for now. Tony, thanks a lot for joining us again. That was Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology at the UW-Madison Veterinary School and associate director for research at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute.